Who were some of the other major officials at the embassy? Who went out of economics affairs for that matter, for example?
Well, when I arrived there, Phil Lathrop was the economic counselor. He was there for, I guess, about 6 months before replacement. Bill Bruin was Bill's replacement. He was there throughout the balance of the period that I was there. He was the economic counselor. Political counselor was Hawk Mills. For about the first 2 years I was there, and then George Lombrakis was replaced Hawk when Hawk went off to become ECM in Athens. we had two different, if not three, I think two different, certainly two different MAG chiefs when I was there. One was son of the former chief of the Air Force, Vandenberg. The last one was there. He was there after I left. Then we had Rocky Brett, who came from. He looked like a prize fighter from Brooklyn, but actually came from a very distinguished military family.
How did you spell his last name?
Brett.
Oh, Brett, okay.
Brett. Family goes back in our history. His father was Lieutenant General. Rocky Fine ended up Lieutenant General. I'm trying to remember the name of our. We have public affairs counselor. Sorry, his name escapes me at the moment. Then we had, within the economic section, we had a science advisor, narcotics people. In the economic section, we had treasury department. Internal Revenue Service people, Department of Agriculture, Department of Commerce, FAA, you know, it's almost a replica of Washington.
Was Alan Conway still the CIA station chief, or was that another person by that time?
Who?
Was Alan Conway still the CIA station chief, or was another person by
no,
this time?
No, it was somebody else.
You can't mention that for a while, so how do you recall?
I can't even remember his name off.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure if I thought about it,
yeah.
But I can't off the top of my head.
Yeah. Okay. Now, you mentioned earlier, talking about the arms sales issues, there was some discussion about the impact, the absorptive capacity question and the question of maintenance and training. Was this something that took much of your time at the embassy, monitoring these issues or discussing handling these issues or following up on them? Or?
Well, we tended to rely heavily on the MAG,
uh-huh.
Military Advisory Group, to do the grunt work on this, and there was an awful lot to be done. And we didn't have the resources at the time to really get into it in great detail. We did have within the political section an officer, a political military officer, who worked very closely with the with our MAG and to a certain degree with the Iranian military themselves in covering in more depth this sort of thing. I relied on the MAG and our political military officer to keep me sort of abreast as did the ambassador. So, you know, intervention into the detail was not something that the ambassador and I did to any great degree. It depends, again, on the question of the issue. But we identified, or we all sort of consciously came to consensus about some of the major problems and the fact that they needed to be addressed, and that we try to keep abreast of what was being done on our side and the Iranian side and the contractor side to deal with these things.
Were there any occasions when the State Department, the Pentagon, was concerned about a particular arms purchase and maybe turned down the child's request or tried to convince him not to make a certain purchase? Or was it never, things never got that far?
Well, following the president's instructions about letting the Shah decide for himself what he wanted to do, so we wouldn't, in any, certainly not to the degree that we had might have in the past, but it would be more in the context if there were a problem, or we thought there would be a problem, would be in terms of absorptive capacity. I mean, you know, can you really do this? Or this is the implications of this purchase in terms of manpower, availability, and training, and all the rest of it. He said, you know, he wanted an American Air Force, and he got very close to just exactly that. In terms of doctrine, training, skills, all of the Iranian pilots took their pilot training in the United States originally. I mean, that would have been caught, got the term they used, but it was pilot training in the United States. They came back. And you walk on an Iranian air base and you might as well be on an American one in terms of the whole setup. Visually and every other way.
Hmm.
They even had, you know, we have the Blue Angels. The Iranians had a counterpart.
Skydivers are
very proficient. Fantastic job.
Now, one aspect of this increase in arms sales, as you already alluded to it earlier, was the growing presence of U.S. technicians.
Mm-hmm.
And trainers in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Did embassy officials fear that this expanded U.S. presence might cause a nationalist reaction in Iran, might have caused cultural and political problems?
Constant.
Yeah.
This is one of my bigger headaches. And how to cope with it. Well, first, to try to keep it within some kind of manageable level. The pressures were always for expansion, always for larger presence, not just on the U.S. government side, but the contractors and all the rest of it. And some of the yahoos they brought over there were real yahoos. I mean, you know. So that in retrospect, it was almost a miracle that we didn't have a lot more incidents, cultural clashes, so on and so forth. But there were a number of occasions where the Iranians were heartily, and with good reason, unhappy with the American presence, or at least specific American individuals and their behavior, which was not good.
What would the embassy do in such cases? Try to encourage them to leave, or what?
Well, we put pressure on the contractors, the managers of the contractors, and the people who were bringing them over, and say, you know, you've really got to get your act together, and if these people can't behave, well, you know, they've got to go. You can't have people like that here. So, trying to influence them, going right back to the recruitment process, I mean the screening process, try and weed out the malcontents and misfits and all the rest of them before they ever get here. But if they do get through this screening process, and they do get through, try to educate them into what kind of environment they're coming and what the priorities are and all the rest of it, because it is a different culture and different people, and you've got to behave accordingly. But if all that fails and you still have these clowns that are misbehaving, then just, get them out.
How responsive were they, generally?
They were generally responsive. They were, I would say, quite sensitive to our views and representations. And we're trying to do it. It's a difficult job. I mean, go out and get 1,500 helicopter trainers, because they were getting an incredible number of helicopters. And a lot of these guys were Vietnam veterans and rough and tough and real cowboys.
Again, I've read somewhere else that there were rumors, maybe actual charges of corruption within the MAG at some point. People getting too close to certain military contractors, Army officials getting too close to certain military contractors or things like that. Did that something come to your attention? Or?
Well, there had been some allegations, some of them pretty vague, that something was not quite right. But it really came down, the only really concrete things that I became aware of were turned out to be really very hardly corruption. I mean, very petty things like, one of the MAG section chiefs or something like that might have had some, I remember one time, bathroom fixtures put in the house that he was provided that were more than they should have. It was a damn thing, petty things. No major scandals. There was allegations from time to time about undue contractor pressures, aided and abetted knowingly or otherwise by the MAG or some MAG person, for purchase of this or that or the other thing. The Schlesinger may have talked about this, because he ended up wanting to have his own man there in Iran with a direct line back to him. I remember I got quite upset about this, because I felt that this could undermine the ambassador's authority, and the ambassador was, in my view, and should be, the final, ultimate authority in the country. I was not prepared, and I didn't want the ambassador to stand for any of his back channels and stuff and all the rest of it. If anything was happening, that he should be in on the takeoff as well as the landing.
Now, one official that Schlesinger visited was Richard Halleck, I guess, initially.
Yeah.
Now, how did that work out in practice, Halleck's?
Well, Halleck's was... I never personally met Halleck. At the time, I think I met him very briefly at some social function later on. But at the time, I did not personally meet him. He did come in and talk to Dick Helms. Dick, in effect, told me he was satisfied with what Halleck was doing, and that he was satisfied that he knew what Halleck was doing. So that was about it. I did become aware at what stage, I don't know, that Halleck had made some concrete recommendations to the Iranians about an air defense system, which we came to believe, I certainly came to believe, didn't make sense insofar as the Iranian situation was concerned. And this was a view that was shared, I think, ultimately by the Pentagon, and certainly by the MAG people over there. The defense was basically to build radar stations virtually around the entire border of the country, and you know, to do this and the manpower involved was, you know, fog of the mind. And that's where the AWACS question came up, because just in terms of cost effectiveness, I mean, there was no comparison, just none whatsoever. You could do with 3 or 4 AWACS planes what you could do with God knows how many of these radar stations. It's totally impractical.
Later on it became, I guess it became almost known that Halleck mixed in his governmental business, which is fraught with private business and private contractors. Did you hear about this at any stage?
In the vaguest terms, nothing concrete.
Yeah. Now later in the fall of 75, Schlesinger sent Erich von Marburg, as a special defense representative in charge of these arms sales issues.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get a sense of what he was up to?
Yes.
You work with him closely?
Oh yeah. No, unlike sort of the mysterious Mr. Halleck, mysterious insofar as I was concerned. Well, first place, when it was proposed that they send a special representative out, I said, now we're going to have terms of reference before this guy ever gets here. And it's going to be agreed on, it's going to be in writing with the Department of Defense. So we sat down and we wrote what the terms of reference would be and exactly where Erich or whoever it might have been would fit into the structure. As I say, one thing I felt very strongly about was sort of lines of authority and responsibility. And so this was done and was accepted by the defense, so that we already had something before Erich ever showed up. And he knew exactly where he fitted in. Insofar as his relations with the MAG were concerned, that was something I was going to worry about. I don't know that there ever were terms of reference in that context. Certainly insofar as his relations with the embassy concerned, particularly with me and the ambassador, why that was clear from the outset.
Now, how did his efforts work out of practice? Did you follow him closely?
Well, Erich would attend, he was a member of the country team, he attended country team meetings. Continuous contact, and indeed sometimes I didn't always get along 100% with the MAG chief, and I ended up sort of having to be a referee between him and the MAG chief.
I should have asked earlier, how did you define his position, basically? What kind of role did you see him playing in the arms sales issue, basically?
To try and help the Iranians set priorities and rationalize their military development efforts, to define the costs, to make choices where choices were evident and or necessary, to do forward planning, a whole range of things like that. And I think that Erich, certainly played a very useful role in all of this.
Did Kissinger have any problems with this proposal? Was it more or less dovetail with his earlier approach towards the Shah, about letting the Shah make his own decisions, or was it seen as a need to make a modification?
No, it wasn't seen as a modification, yeah. I don't think yeah. at all, yeah. not at all. I think it was more, you know, within the framework and context of this general yeah. policy that this was just part of the implementation, if you will, of it, and we're trying to be helpful.
Okay. All right. Now, apparently, I guess that same year in the fall, James Schlesinger was becoming more and more concerned about the volume of arms sales.
About what?
The volume of arms sales to Iran. Huge increase. And apparently, he requested President Ford to have the NSC do a special study of policy towards Iran and the Persian Gulf states generally. Did you hear about his request? Did that ever come to your attention?
Yes, it did, but I can't remember. Well, we didn't get deeply involved in it. As I recall, at some stage or another, I think we'd heard about it, of course, and I think that I had registered that view that we sure as hell wanted to see the draft and have an opportunity to make whatever comments seemed to be appropriate. Indeed, I think we did, in fact, get the draft and make whatever comments we felt were appropriate. After that, I don't, you know.
Did you ever get beyond? Did it get beyond the draft level that you know of? Or?
I can't tell you.
Yeah. Do you recall what the thrust of it might have been? The thrust of the paper, or like the restatement of the earlier policy, basically. Or?
Sorry.
Okay. Let me ask a couple OPEC questions. On September 74, fall 74, sometimes Henry Kissinger came to Tehran to meet with the Shah to discuss oil price questions, I guess international economic implications of oil price increases. Were you president at that meeting, or did you?
I was not president.
Did you hear what might have happened?
I mean, Dick was the count was there then. And, and I know that the visit, certainly insofar as press was concerned, was characterized as this. My perception was that this was not the, by any means, the full burden of his visit. There were a lot of other things. The international is always, you know, big thinkers and things. It's got the geopolitical environment of the world and all the rest of it. Yeah, there was some, I do know that there was some exchange between Kissinger and the Shah on the subject. The details of which I don't recall, but there were things. I think I remember even in advance of our saying out, telling Kissinger, here's what he's going to say, to what you have to say, so you will know, because we'd already been through this several times, and that's like one or another element of the government, so. It was an exchange.
Now later, the following year, during the depths of the recession of 75, 76, I guess Kissinger warned in public that the U.S. might seize some oil fields in the Gulf area if OPEC price increases continued and strangled the West economically. Did this statement have any particular impact on relations with Iran?
Yeah, sure got the wind up. And I don't remember the precise scenario or conduit, but we certainly were told one way or another. We wondered, Shah wanted to know right away what the hell was he talking about, what did he mean? I mean, that sort of happened with the speed of light. got an answer back what we should tell the founder, what it meant, which was certainly not confrontational.
What were you told to?
I don't remember the details, but I do remember that it was not confrontational.
Yeah. Was there serious consideration given to developing plans or along those lines, or Kissinger's statements back in Washington? Was that just like something else? What was the point?
I really never knew exactly how serious this might have been in the minds of some people back in Washington. As far as I was concerned, it was ludicrous. Somehow we were going to come parachute in there and take over the oil fields, which is, as I say, ludicrous. And I think that applied to the other side of the Gulf too, I think. Although the Saudis may have taken it a little more seriously, they were more nervous about it. And you'd get a report about some U.S. Army division exercising in the desert of Texas or Nevada or something like that. This was sort of a run through for the real thing, and et cetera, et cetera. But it did get the wind up, there's no doubt about that.
And in the summer of 1974, I guess as this oil revenue expanded, the Shah doubled the national investment program. Investment was planned to go to very great levels, billions and billions of dollars. Did the Shah,
against the advice of almost everybody.
Did they discuss this with you or the ambassador?
Well, this was basically, we felt, an internal policy. Yeah. It was his money and so forth. But when I say against the advice of almost everybody, that means his own ministry. I think including the prime minister. Now, it had always been the Shah's practice to set goals which seemed to be well beyond anybody's reach. And this was just a tactic. Well, just a tactic, maybe is a slight distortion. It was a tactic, and he's saying, if I don't set these goals, then we're not going to go anywhere, because people will say, well, what's realistic and what is possible, and so forth, and we'll never emerge from the 16th century. So I've got to set these ambitious goals, albeit we may fall somewhat short, but still we'll go somewhere. But when he did this in whatever it was, 1974 or whatever, as I say, against the advice of almost everybody. I mean, it's like a sailor going, shore leave after 6 months on the ship, and he'd saved up 6 months of pay, and he was going to rip me to it.
Did this decision cause concern at the embassy?
Sure.
About its potentially destabilizing impact?
I don't know, per se, destabilizing effect. I mean, it was so far out and again, because of the manpower constraints and so forth, that the infrastructure constraints, you know, have these trucks that are going to go up and down there. The only real load that's going to pound the hell out of it within 6 months. We'd have to build the whole thing all over again. I mean, just one out of many, many, many considerations. The congestion in the port, I mean, it just couldn't move this stuff out of the port. It was wild.
Okay.
Well, I mean, finally, sorry to just jump ahead a bit, but it finally became apparent that this really was not doable. and it really was calling, causing severe dysfunction in the economy, and would swap over into the social, political side of things too. And he began to back off.
When was this?
Well, when he put Jamshid Muzaffar in as prime minister, and basically Jamshid's was given the mandate, if not total authority, to get things back under control.
This is the 77, 78?
No, Jamshid.
Earlier than that?
No. Jamshid became prime minister, I think, either late 76 or beginning of 77, somewhere around there. He was prime minister when I left. Matter of fact, very graciously gave a farewell lunch for me, which was unusual. I was due for DCM, unusual to say the least. I mean, it never happened.
No, when Ford, after Ford became president, 74, was there any particular shift or modification in the approach of the Shah? Was there any?
No.
Some officials have
suggested that. Well, of course, Kissinger's still there.
Some people suggest there's a little bit of a cooling of the relationship between the White House and the Shah because different personalities.
As always with any change in administration, there was always evidence of uncertainty in the court. Not the Shah personally, although it probably was the Shah. How's this guy going to be and what's he going to do? So there was an initial period, but this again was not unusual. There was an initial period of uncertainty with every new administration until there was either a substantive message or a meeting or some specific actions which convinced the Shah that things were okay. In the case of Ford, I think it was fairly early on in Ford's administration where Shah came to the United States. And this was part of, letting him know that, things were no problem.
During this period when you were in Iran, mid-70s, did you ever get kind of a sense of the atmosphere of the Shah's court? Including who were some of the major advisors and their influence.
Very few people had, by that time, the Shah had become very much his own man. The court was, by and large, ceremonial functionaries and so forth. They weren't any real advisors in that sense. The Shah would, I would say, Jamshid Muzaffar, of course, even before he was prime minister, he was the principal representative of OPEC councils all the time, and had been a senior minister of one sort or another for years. So Jamshid was one person that saw the Shah. Hushang Ansari was another. As long as he was alive, Dr. Iqbal, who went way back and was one of two closest advisors to the Shah, along with being the other one. Of course, the Prime Minister Hoveyda, preceding Muzaffar. There were several of the military people. Heads of his military services, and Savak, the head of Savak.
Did any of these individuals have real influence on their own?
No.
In terms of the Shah, influencing his, maybe the ability to change his mind, say, or influence his thinking.
I would say only Alam and Iqbal. the alarm and that fall. I mean, if he really made up his mind, and even then, you know, it was, it had to be a, well, I you know, I, obviously I wasn't privy to it. But I would say if there was anybody, oh, and the Queen. And, you know, for example, the question of legal rights, and making himself a little more accessible, or at least appearing to be more accessible and flexible and that sort of thing, Queen played a really quite important role in that area. And and also was an important factor in, to the degree that the royal family enjoyed a, you know, a fairly good reputation, and seen with some affection. She was a major factor in that.
Well, there was a charge that there was some corruption among the Shaw's family or the people around the Shaw's family. Did you get a sense of that?
To
what extent?
Well, this sort of ebbed and flowed,
yeah.
And I'm sure there was corruption, and I'm sure that at some point, you know, it just got to be too much, and Shaw or somebody would say, oh, no, you know, that's it. And as I recall it once, well, first he, and then, and sorry, this jumping back and forth in time, but he cut off his the royal family from outsiders. He in effect told him, you know, you just aren't dealing with outsiders. Now that didn't hold for Ashraf, his twin sister, and for a few others I've forgotten now. But so we in the embassy, we didn't see other members of the royal family, except on an official, say, state visit or something like that. But otherwise, we didn't see them at all. So we didn't know as much about what was going on in any direct sense as we heard this grapevine or that person and so on and so forth. But I don't have any serious doubt at all that there wasn't corruption. There certainly was. Corruption in the Persian context is not quite the same thing. It's endemic in a certain sense. There's always bakshish, you know, from the lowest peasant on the key bearer and whatever, right on up. It's just when it gets to be, you know, beyond reasonable bounds, like 30% instead of 5% or something like that.
I've also, in Gary Sick's book, he suggested some embassy officials, during the 70s, tended to refer to the Shah in reverential terms, like his Imperial Majesty, something, you know, when they talk about him among themselves. Was that a common routine? Was he making more of it than there was?
I never heard it. Yeah. I mean, when we were talking to ourselves, it was just the Shah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, when you addressed him, it was his Imperial Majesty. I mean, that's the way you addressed him.
Yeah.
But nobody was saying, Imperial Majesty this or Imperial Majesty that. I never heard that.
Okay.
I can't imagine it. No.
Yeah, I was surprised when I saw him. That's how they comment. But I thought, well, I'd ask just to check up on this. According to some of the captured documents, which an article I read about them, some accounts of them, during this period, some intelligence experts had some concern about the Shah's political and psychological reliability. Were you familiar with those speculations? Whether he could be depended upon in a crunch, I guess, in terms of working with the United States.
I don't recall anything specific, but let me say this. We never assumed that the Shah was going to do something that he did not see as being in his and or Iran's best interest. So whenever we considered an approach on a given question, either consciously or otherwise, we presented it in a way which would illustrate or highlight the mutuality of that interest or that course of action, or whatever it might be. If there's one thing certain you could say about the Shah, he was an Iranian first, very much a nationalist, a ferocious nationalist, you might say, and which accounted for a lot of things that we did. So, you know, say that he might not be reliable, there might have been some speculation that, you know, he might not see that the way we see it, and therefore he might not do it. It could have been some of that. I don't recall any specific example or detail.
Okay. Let's wrap up now for today. Thank you very much for your time.